We will reconvene. Item number two, which is the 2017-19 proviso update and workshop. Mr. Nate, I turn it over to you, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, and Director Storr. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Policy Director with the Department. And today I'm joined by Elizabeth McManus, who is a principal with Ross Strategic, who is a consultant firm that we've contracted with to help us facilitate our budget and policy advisory group. So, thanks for joining. Today, I wanted to go through a few items here in this workshop. We'll start with just a reminder of the scope of the proviso and some of the key budget decisions that we have to make here in the next couple months. I'll provide an overview of what we've done here in the past month with our budget and policy advisory group. Elizabeth will present some work Ross Strategic has done on researching fish and wildlife budgets in 15 other states. And then we'll talk a little bit about the long-term funding plan and some budget principles. I'd like to spend a little bit of time looking at our March workshop and then close answering a couple questions that were asked by you at your meeting in Ridgefield. And we'll have Melinda Posner with in the Lands Division provide a presentation on the Ruckelshaus process that examined setting fees on state recreation lands. And then Megan West, who's our federal coordinator, will provide a briefing to you on Recovering America's Wildlife Act. So a lot to pack in for a couple hours, but appreciate you all spending some time having this workshop, learning about some of these issues, because, again, we have some pretty big decisions that we're going to be asking of you soon. So just a brief reminder on the scope of the proviso. There's three components of this proviso, and this was language that was included in the 17-19 operating budget adopted by the legislature in late June. And the proviso had provided us $10.1 million in general fund state to shore up the agency's budget, and it came with some strings. And those strings included that we needed to contract with a consultant to look at our organization's effectiveness in different administrative processes and decision-making. There was a component that had us develop a long-term revenue plan to try to get to secure, stable funding with politically viable options. And they asked us to do a zero-based budget analysis. In your packet, and this, I think, was just handed out, there was three documents that are outside of your notebook. There's a document titled A Rough Sketch of Key Budget Decisions. And just wanted to walk you through what's coming down the pike. So at Ridgefield, we showed you this document, which is that I have displayed here, which is our zero-based budget analysis. Essentially, all of the expenditures from last biennium divided up into seven or eight key outcomes and the associated strategies. And this is 100% of expenditures across our operating and capital budget. This was, I think, we're getting a lot of mileage out of this document. It's been really helpful internally to look at how different program areas are interrelated to achieving the agency's mission. It serves as a really helpful orientation to the department's budget. And it shows exactly where we spent our money. I mean, that's kind of one reflection of priorities would be where we put the dollars. So when we think about looking at for 2017 and 19, this current biennium, we balanced the budget with a $27 million problem statement, of which $21.3 million was in one-time solutions. Part of that was that $10.1 million that came with the proviso. The proviso had language in it that had us balance the budget that said that we needed to avoid hatchery closures and minimize impacts to hunting and fishing opportunities. So we have not mapped our current spending plans, i.e. our allotments, to this framework, and that's something that we need to do now for this biennium. In doing so, as we prepare for next biennium's budget, which you all will be we're asking you to adopt our budget request next September, and we have to submit our long-term funding plan in May. So at your April meeting, you'll be adopting our plan. we know that there's probably going to be at least $26 million of service delivery cuts to these activities that I've displayed on the screen here. So we can go about closing that gap in a couple ways. We can take the cuts, we can request general fund state, or we can pursue some combination of those as well as figure out a way to try to stabilize the state wildlife account. And in particular, the non-restricted portion, which is where hunting and fishing license fees are deposited. So we think it's really valuable here as we're working on the long-term funding plan to come up with a series of budget principles, because it's really easy as we work with our advisory group and others for folks to say, well, why don't you just do this to this one fee? And what we're trying to do is say, let's back up a little bit, and what are our overarching principles of how we think the services that the department provides should be funded, and what's the appropriate funding source for us to do that service? Ideally, you'd have this sequence where we also had the strategic plan for next biennium completed and adopted by you. The timing that we have for May and September, it's not going to be possible for us to have that done. So what we're envisioning is our long-term funding plan is this kind of foundational document. It outlines the first phase of how to get to a stable budget and then sets a platform for us to work on going forward. And so that's where on this sheet, again, this rough sketch, I put down the goal here is not only to get us through for 1921, but when we're out two bienniums, looking at 21-23, that we have a stable carry forward level in our budget, that we have a mechanism to fund the maintenance level increases that we know happen every biennium, and that we don't just start drifting apart like happens to us every 6 or 8 years, where we work with the legislature, get a fee increase, we're fine for one biennium, and then we start seeing a departure between the authority that we receive to spend money and actually having the revenue behind it. We would also have our budget enhancements requests tied to our strategic plan, and adds and cuts and repurposed funding, again, are based on our performance measures in the strategic plan. So I hope that roadmap lets you know kind of where we're headed. And the sequencing of items isn't ideal, but I think we're doing the best that we can given the timelines that we need to make to meet for the legislature. So I'll pause there to see if that was clear as mud.
Mud.
Okay. So since our last meeting in Ridgefield, the Budget and Policy Advisory Group, again, composed of 20 members, 20 citizens, hunters and rec fishers, commercial fishers, Association of Washington Business, the counties are represented, conservationists. We've had a few meetings. We had a number of meetings just on the zero-based budget where we had staff and working with Ross Strategic go out to Spokane and Seattle and other areas and just try to pull the advisory group members that lived in that area together to really walk them through and orient them to our budget. We've had a couple webinars where we've explained the Matrix Consulting Report to them so that they could understand that content and start to discuss what are those key findings that we'll want to undertake as part of our long-term funding plan, as well as just yesterday we had our in-person meeting. And just got to say, it is a fun group. It's a talented group. I would encourage you. We've got a meeting coming up in March, early March. If you're interested and able to come and see their deliberations, I think you'll be really, really impressed. They're diving in, and we had a 8-hour discussion yesterday on the agency budget, and 17 people stayed engaged the whole time, and they're tracking it, and they're offering just great insights for us. At yesterday's meeting, we talked about the findings from the zero-based budget analysis, the matrix report, and we started to develop some funding principles. And so I'll share with you the results of some of that conversation here shortly. So at this stage, I'd like to turn it over to Elizabeth, and she can walk through some of the work Ross Strategic has done on researching other state agencies. I'll give you the mouse, but I can try to fire it up here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Director Store. As Nate said, my name's Elizabeth McManus, and I work with a company called Ross Strategic, and we were pleased and grateful to be selected to support the Budget and Policy Advisory Group effort. So as part of our work, As part of our work, one of the things we did was prepare some background information for the group on other state fish and wildlife agencies, or I should say fish and wildlife agencies in other states, I suppose. There's no right way to have a fish and wildlife agency, and it's not really possible to make apples-to-apples comparisons, so I don't want you to think of this really as a benchmarking exercise. It was more of a research exercise to try to gain ideas and see how other people do it and what that might spark for the group. So we looked at 16 states. Those were states that were either selected by Budget and Policy Advisory Group members because they had heard they were doing something interesting, or they're states that were selected by DFW staff for the same reason. Okay, so there's going to be a series of these stacked bar charts, and they just kind of show you what we learned and how Washington compares to the states that we looked at. You'll see that 11 of the 16 states we looked at have asterisks next to their names on the bottom there. Those are states where we verified the budget data with state employees. The other five states were still working on that verification. The data was drawn from publicly available documents and state websites, but it hasn't been verified by a human who lives there and works in that agency yet. So we're still working on that. So you can see where Washington is in comparison to California, with the largest budget, and Vermont at the end. The colors show funding sources, so general fund, license fees, non-consumptive user fees, federal funds, and other. Other are things like dedicated revenue sources within the state that don't flow through the general fund. So, for example, some states have a slice of their lottery that goes to their Fish and Wildlife Agency. Okay. This just reiterates why apples-to-apples comparisons are different or difficult. So this sort of puts some context around the states that we looked at. So you can see where Washington is in terms of population. It's pretty large. Where it is in terms of size. Where it is in terms of wildlife acres under management. I think the other thing we've really heard from people that is a difference in Washington is, you know, we're one of four states that we looked at with marine fish management responsibilities, and we're really one of the only states with tribal co-management responsibilities quite like they are here west of the Cascades. This talks about the percentage of funding that comes from the general fund. You'll see a number of states don't receive any general fund money. Washington receives 21% of its budget from general fund, which was quite high compared to the other states we evaluated. Okay. And this talks about funding from licenses and fees. So you see the wide range there and where Washington ends up. We also did a little bit of looking at the cost of licenses and fees just to compare that. And this is really work that Peter Verney and the Fish and Wildlife Department here and his team helped with a lot. So we tried to compare what it would cost totally to go out the door and hunt a deer in Washington to other states, same with elk, small game, freshwater fish, and sports package. And you can see those numbers here. Washington's around the middle here. You know, let's say we're near the median, okay? And then this is the same sort of assessment for non-resident participation, and we're on the high end. I think it's fair to say we're on the high end for non-resident. Okay. Then we also looked at process simplification measures or incentives that some states have put in place for licenses and fees. And that was really following a thread that Budget and Policy Advisory Group members mentioned to us during our initial interviews where, you know, there are people that are very interested in some of these approaches or offerings. I guess that's the right thing to call them, offerings. So lifetime license, you see where those are, multi-year license, and sports package. And my understanding, although I'm far from expert on this, is that some of these are under consideration or maybe even in progress in the department right now. Okay? Okay, so here's the part where I think it gets pretty interesting and applicable for the budget policy advisory group work that we're doing. Nine of the states that we evaluated had undergone similar processes to try to set the stage for sustainable funding over the long term for the agency. They had work groups, they looked at principles, they tried to figure out what kind of fish and wildlife agency they wanted in the future, and they made recommendations. So one of the things that they did is they talked about criteria for evaluating funding options. That's something that the Budget Policy Advisory Group will also have to wrestle with. So these are some examples of criteria that came from other state assessment programs. They also came up with recommended funding sources, something that the Budget and Policy Advisory Group will have to take on. So those are some ideas for recommended funding sources that were put forward by groups in other states. Principles. And the Budget Policy Advisory Group looked at these yesterday and considered them. Okay, so what did we really learn that's helpful? Well, you know, it's very variable. Apples to apples comparisons are probably not useful, but there are examples out there that we can look to for states that have been down this road ahead of us, and we might learn from that, or they might spark something of interest on the group. Is there anything else you wanted me to cover?
On the chart that was related to license fees, I don't know what page it was. No, the one before that said the, there you go. One of the things that we hear over and over from interest groups is that essentially it's important for us to consider their point of view because they fund our agency. So this slide shows that approximately 18% of our budget is from license fees. And I'm sorry, this probably isn't a question for you, but maybe Nate. Can that be broken down by a percentage of the fishing budget for fishing license fees and the percentage of, I don't know what the hunting budget is, by hunting budget fees? Is that information we could get?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Baker, yes. And just roughly, and I'll probably fact check here with David Giglio behind me, but about half of our license fees are the amount that we get per biennium is derived from hunting, and about half is from fishing.
He's gone.
David's not here.
I will follow up with you for sure, but that's pretty close to the balance in terms of the origin of the fees. And then generally, you know, when we look at hunting and fishing contributions, you know, in a different color of money, and the federal side is where we usually track Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson funds, but certainly that's based on the number of those formulas for those block grants are based on number of licenses sold as well. So it's, you know, generally, even though here it says 18%, it's 25-30% of our budget can be attributed to hunting and fishing based dollars.
Yes, thanks for the presentation here. In terms of the conclusions of what might help us, slide 13 is titled Recommended Funding Source Examples. So I know that our sister state to the south, Oregon, went through one of these things, and they ended up saying add another nickel to the can tax or the container tax or something. I think it's 5 cents now, and they were saying the best way to fund fish and wildlife is to go up another 5 cents.
Oh, to go up.
Maybe it's 10 now, and they were talking about going to 15. I'm not sure, but it was something on the order of that. So, the interesting thing about this slide, when you first talked about it, was it says recommended funding source examples. So are these successful examples? So for the first one, dedicated percentage of state tax, that's an idea. Is that an idea that worked for Florida and Minnesota and New Mexico and Maine and Missouri, or is that a recommendation that came out of the agency that failed?
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I probably this is a confusing title for the slide. So the recommended here refers to these advisory groups that the agencies sponsored. So these are funding sources recommended by their respective advisory groups. For the most part, we don't know if they're successful or not. A lot of them are in the same place as Oregon. They have this proposal for the beverage tax, and they're also looking at income tax return surcharge in Oregon, and they're trying to get those through the legislature right now. So we don't know if they're successful or not yet. And that's the case with most of these because the groups really operated pretty recently. I think you can also, you know, compare some of these ideas with the chart earlier that talks about overall budgets for fish and wildlife agencies and sort of see who's growing their budget and who isn't. And we haven't done that comparison, but we certainly could.
So in terms of hunting and fishing license fee increase seems to be the one that is most successful, at least having been increased in the past. Did you survey the states to find out what has worked and what has failed?
We did not survey the states. We did internet research, and then we verified numbers with states who would speak with us. We can, and I can't do it off the top of my head, but we can certainly go back through our data and tell you which of these funding sources have been enacted and are sustained. So, for example, there are states that get a slice of the lottery. There are states that have a slice of sales tax dedicated. We can list which ones have been, you know, have that, and you can consider it.
Similar or follow-up on that, do you know of any state that funds any percent of its budget, fish and wildlife, from beverage sale containers?
Mr. Chair, I don't, but that it doesn't mean it isn't out there.
Right. When you're doing the other searches, that would be something, because I don't know of any that do, and I, on first blush, it seems like that's a good idea. I just wonder if for this state, getting something like that through the legislature might be, but if we had some comparison.
Sir.
Any other questions on the state research? So I'll turn now to, in your notebook, right after your summary sheet, is a document that's titled the Draft Long-Term Funding Plan. And what we have before you is just our outline. And what we wanted to do here is we're going to be very busy over the next 2 months writing this document based on this framework. And so if there's elements to this that you would like to see us include or a slightly different direction, that would really help us out now, because we've got basically 2 months to write this and get it to you for your consideration at your April meeting. So the outline, we start off with the introduction, kind of the background on the proviso, and a summary of some of the key questions that this plan addresses. Missing a page in mine.
I didn't bring it. I'm sorry.
Then we go through some background information on the history of the department's budget, our different funding sources, our why we have a structural deficit. Thanks, Tammy. And we're also missing that page as well. That's great. We're all missing a
page two.
We're missing page two. So,
We worked on the outline. We can talk a little bit about what's on page two. So let me look at page one, and then I'll remember maybe where the break point is. Okay, so you can see the introduction, which talks about what questions the report would answer. You've got it up online.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Great. So then we would talk about the department's mission and role. Again, this has been very important to the Budget and Policy Advisory Group, and they talk about it as this notion of telling the story. The other part of telling the story is really the zero-based budgeting work that you've seen. What is the department's funding? Where does it currently come from? What is it accomplishing with its funding as best we can know it? Then we talk about the shortfall. And I'll draw your attention to two pieces there under the shortfall, describing the potential makeup. How could you fill the shortfall from efficiencies? That would be drawn largely from the independent performance review that Matrix did. And then what part of the shortfall could you make up or should you make up from expenditure reductions? That was specifically requested in the proviso. So those two things are there. Then we would talk about funding needs and priorities for the next two biennia. Nate talked about that when he talked about his outline. Principles for sustainable funding. Funding options and evaluation results. The proviso requires that funding options be evaluated using some specific criteria. The Budget Policy Advisory Group will have to use those criteria, and they might also have additional criteria that they suggest or apply. And then something that's been very important to them so far is the idea of the longer-term path to sustainable funding. So as Nate talked about, this is the notion of rolling into strategic planning, improving the performance measures, improving the ability to tie funding to outcomes. And then, of course, over time, circling back to the sustainable funding plan to make adjustments that might flow from that longer-term effort.
So as we go through, I mean, we're busy right now starting to write the summary information on our mission and role and the current funding and expenditures. The ZBB analysis really launched us forward on how we're messaging around this. The Matrix document, I think, did a nice job of summarizing the shortfall, so we'll borrow a lot of that language and summary from them to include for this portion. And our next item for our workshop is really start talking about the principles section.
Just make a comment on I thought the Matrix description was really, really good. One point I think about in terms of the proviso, saying, you know, what kinds of cuts can be made to close this. There needs to be, it seems to me, real emphasis put on the limitation to that we're simply talking about state funding and where the cuts are going to be made. Because, you know, a true ZBB analysis would look at the whole agency, and it seems to me that probably a lot of the things that the public would question are not state funded. And, you know, why the heck are you doing that? Well, we have a restricted grant that does it. And I think, you know, one of these principles that the BPAC has come up with, tie funding requests through the legislature and federal grants to goals and objectives mm-hmm. of the department strategic plan going forward, is really important. But what we're living with now is not this necessarily. And so just a lot of thought, it seems to me, needs to go into how we talk about expenditure cuts and that they are limited in terms of the department's mission and strategies, because it's state funding only that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Thorburn, just a couple thoughts to respond with. First, the funding strings that came with the $10.1 million was for this biennium.
Right.
And so when we balanced the budget, we did everything we could to avoid cuts to hatcheries and minimize impacts to hunting and fishing. There were still some impacts to hunting and fishing. I mean, it's just, there's only so many other areas for us to look when we look across our budget. And certainly, you know, when I think about the problem statements that we're talking about on the order of $25 million to $30 million, and you think about the agency budget of $450 million of operating budget, that's a kind of a small portion. Why aren't you just living within in the margins? But when you look at, and the point that you were making is that you look at the essentially the flexible funding or the state funding, which is around between state wildlife account and general fund, now you're in the order of about a third of our budget. Mm-hmm. And so when you take a 25% of 120, 130 millions, that's real. And that's where the discretion comes in. And that's where a lot of the services that folks are see more explicitly tied to the mission of the department, because some of the other aspects were carrying out federal obligations or mitigation agreements from counties or federal hydro facilities or specific work that we're contracted to do for the feds. So you're right. Two-thirds of our budget almost gets set aside when we're starting to talk about the zero-based budget. And when we have to live within our means, it's a pretty significant portion of the budget of the numbers that we're talking about here. And that's why, I mean, I appreciate the commission's engagement on this and why I've been bringing this to you every month, because these are some pretty heavy decisions that we're going to be making here in the next couple months. And I don't want to be in the same position that we were in a year or so ago, where we had a similar problem statement. We came up with a pretty significant fee bill, and we did not have the political support behind it. Okay. So shifting to some draft funding principles, and again, these would be kind of our compass bearings for how we would go about closing our budget gap in going forward. And admittedly, in your packet, and this was just one of the loose documents handed to you at the start of this presentation, we've divided it up into a few categories, and it's a blend of principles and recommendations. And please recognize that this was trying to distill a conversation from yesterday and turning it around and presenting it to today. But some general principles, for instance, all funding requests must include their full share of administrative costs. That was one of the findings in the matrix report. Department should seek an inflation clause for all state fund sources, and perhaps tie it to a consumer price index or some other inflation scale. One of the items that the advisory groups told us yesterday is they said, well, let's maybe consider an inflation clause after you've closed the structural deficit, because it might be that they just say, here's an inflation clause, you're good, and we haven't addressed the $25 million shortfall. So there was some recommendation on timing of when this item would be pursued. There were some principles discussed about pursuing general fund requests and making sure that those activities that the agency is investing in could be tied or something that all citizens would see as a benefit. It contributes to Washingtonians' way of life, or there's an expectation of the department managing biodiversity or other conservation activities. Or perhaps a principle for general fund is that it's a funding that's invested that's a further driver of other economic benefits. So, for instance, commercial fisheries management, or even some recreational fisheries management, where a dollar invested in hatchery, and then there's harvest going on in a rural town, and then you have that multiplier effect of that's contributing back into the general fund. We had some draft principles in the state wildlife account. The matrix report encouraged the department to look at separating the non-restricted portion of the state wildlife account and the restricted portion. I think what that's really getting at is there's approximately 25 sub-accounts within the broader state wildlife account. And when the legislature looks at the fund balance of all 25 accounts, it looks like, hey, that's a pretty good, healthy fund balance. And what they're not seeing is that, well, a lot of that is tucked away in very individual accounts with very specific purposes, and it doesn't have that much flexibility that we could just move over and fund anything else under Title 77. This is something that we've ran a few times, but it's to have all of the commercial fishing license fees and excise tax deposited into the state wildlife account as well to help us manage our commercial fisheries. And then on the back page, we just outlined some initial principles for user fee requests. A recommendation from the advisory group was to try to secure modest fee increases each year or every other year on a biennium basis rather than flat fees for 6 to 8 years, and all of a sudden to try to catch up with inflation, it feels like it's a really big lift. There's a principle about when we do adjust fees that the department should be very transparent on whether or not it's going to go towards cost recovery for the management of that activity, or is it something that's used to generate revenue to fund other activities within Title 77. And then a variety of items, and this is also called out for in the proviso, but we need to look at, in setting fees, that it's going to be politically viable. Consider the cost of administration of that fee program. Offer price points that optimize recruitment and retention. And consider the user's ability to actually pay and afford those different fees. There's a lot of discussion right now, and the Ruckels House process started to look at this on the access to state lands, is considering what are costs associated for families or seniors or persons with disabilities. And then just some more recommendations that we kind of closed out with yesterday with the Budget and Policy Advisory Group. Folks had noted that we should probably look more towards working with federal partners and the Washington Congressional delegation to make sure that some of our federal grants are keeping pace with inflation. Some of our contracts are reimbursable contracts, so we can charge exactly what we paid, and so we're able to keep up with inflation. Certainly PR and DJ are excise tax grants, so as costs of ammunition and firearms and fishing tackle goes up, those block grants tend to rise as well over time. But a lot of our grants, like Mitchell Act or some Section 6 agreements or our joint enforcement agreements, can be flatlined. And so as we have those incremental cost of living adjustments over time, it just erodes our buying power in those federal grants. We heard a general recommendation for exploring more public-private partnerships, and this is the part that I thought was really neat from the advisory group, is members that are coming to us from the private sector and talking more about, you know, looking at our agency's business model, and again, kind of reflecting this more about the way we use it as our strategic plan. But you know, where we have flexibility in our fund source, there was support for us to take a fresh look and identify what are those key priorities, and let's move flexible funding where we can and push forward on the priorities that the commission's identified for us. Yes, there's going to be other grants that we can't move to that priority, but where we can, we should. And so with that, I just wanted to do a check-in here to see if there was other principles that you would like for us to consider, or any thoughts or reactions on what I shared.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks, Nate and Elizabeth. I'll just note on that last one, as I was listening to that yesterday, I was able to attend the tail end of the BPAG meeting yesterday, and I support what Nate said about the group, really thoughtful and engaged. As this business model discussion was happening, I was thinking, we also saw that in Matrix as well, you know, yep. Get more measurable and show your outcomes. I'm not sure how well I'm going to be able to articulate the rest of my thoughts. I was really struck by the single public who got up and commented. What he noted was that there had been more in the audience in the morning, but he was the only public, only unattached individual. I don't know whether that claim was accurate with the entire group, but he seemed to have researched it, who came and sat through this meeting. And it related to some comments that I heard from BPAG members that we it's about marketing, kind of, and the challenge that this organization faces in defining itself as really, I see as, while BPAG members were saying, you know, it's the legislators who are the trustees of this public trust, our state's Fish and Wildlife, and the lands they live on. I really see us as, we're at least the implementers of the trust. And we do surveys. I think we understand that at some level, Washingtonians really care about this trust. And somehow, Washingtonians don't understand that that's what we do. We conserve and protect this trust that Washingtonians care about. And we need to, and I think that's what, you know, the testifier was kind of saying to us, too. There should be a lot of people who are engaged in, I know it was a work day, but, you know, there should be people who are coming and listening to these really important discussions about the future of this agency that carries out that trust responsibility. We care. We Washingtonians care. There was some discussion about that. And it's reflected a little bit in that, but I think it's a really key in principle piece. One other item, and I'm not sure how to capture it in principles, but it's a great group, but it's a bunch of old white guys. I know if Jen had been there, the average age would have gone down a little bit. But that's who we are always talking to. That is not who Washingtonians are, and it's not who the future of this agency is. And we need to, and I didn't see a single, I saw some principles that, I'm pointing over here because they were up on the wall, that talked about marketing. Who are we, marketing is defining the audience and being inclusive. We've got to capture that, and we're not a bunch of old white guys that are going to save our fish and wildlife and the habitats. We need to capture that in the principle somehow. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, one of the, as far as the membership of the advisory group, when we identified members this late in 2017, which we tried to make sure all those sectors were represented, definitely factored in and had some input on geographic representation. There was a comment that we didn't have very many people from the east side of the state, and so we added on some members there. I think once we get through this spring pulse, I'd like to talk with our advisory group and think about broadening and what are the other sectors and what are the other kinds of aspects to round out our group, because this is a group we would anticipate will survive long past the proviso timelines. We're seeing a lot of benefit from this, and as we bring forward projects like strategic plan or future agency request legislation, it's nice to have a sounding board like this that's not in just the Game Management Advisory Council or just in a specific fisheries advisory group or just in one wildlife area, for folks that are looking statewide and across the entire bandwidth of the agency. We heard a lot of suggestions yesterday about marketing and transparency and making sure the public was aware of where their money is going, what the agency is investing it in, what are those choices that the agency is making. And again, this is where this one example, this tool of putting all the money on the table and having it organized is helpful for us. I was talking to Michelle Culver in Fish Program this morning, and she had attended the advisory group yesterday and made a comment about as we think about messaging for this, it's important that, so right now on this framework, you'll see that we have the preserve, protect, perpetuate component of our mission on the upper half, and then the rec and commercial fishing and hunting and non-consumptive recreation on kind of the bottom portion of this map. but a huge chunk of investment of managing fishing opportunities is to manage around the species that are the limiting factors and to making sure that we're achieving our recovery objectives. And so, you know, even there, I mean, even this layout, it was just something that I know as you all know, I have more of a wildlife background, and I think about that from the hunting perspective. A lot of the hunting revenue for the hunting opportunities column is going towards those basic population surveys to make sure that the population's at a sustainable level, and then some of the hunting revenue is around actually cutting the regs. But our first priority is to make sure that that population's healthy and sustainable. And so when you start thinking about the conservation elements of hunting and commercial fishing and rec fishing and even conservation hatcheries, a lot of money we could park upstairs of the document, if you will. But just for convenience and binning, we moved it down below, so it was a discrete object. So we need to do a lot better job, I think, in general, telling our budget story and showing how interconnected the different programs are. I think it's going to be really common for people to look at this and say, well, gosh, you know, we'd like you to spend more money in a particular cell, and perhaps you move it from another one. And it's like, well, those are the cells on investing in, for instance, habitat, you know, project approvals, HPAs, hydraulic project approvals, benefits your fishing opportunity. And so how do we be very explicit about those connections? So with that, see if there's other questions, and I'll show you another tool that we have for displaying our budget information.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't have a question. I'm listening, and this is very interesting to me. I listened to Commissioner Thorburn, but I guess I want to have kind of a reality check here a little bit. And it may be, no, it is, clearly because of my 40 years in the private sector, working with the primary cash contributors to the agency, the hunters and the fishermen, the hunters, pick them whatever order you want. But I had a pretty affluent customer base for 40 years. And pretty knowledgeable people, a lot of professional people, lawyers, doctors, others. And this is what I struggle with. And I engaged with people 6 days a week for 40 years. The commentary, Nate, and I'm not picking on you at all, the commentary that we have all this support out there amongst our user groups is frankly the farthest thing from the truth. It's significantly less than 1%. It's probably less than 0.1% of the people that recreationally, commercially, hike, whatever it may be, really understand or care what we do. Mm-hmm. They don't. The people that work at Boeing, Weyerhaeuser, PACCAR, pick them. They assume very clearly that WFW is taking care of their opportunity to get out and participate in whatever their hobby may be. The struggle that I have, and it goes back to the term you use a number of times, is messaging. We somehow have to get these people more engaged. And I know you know that and you support that, but we haven't done a job doing it yet. We have not moved the ball one bit, and a pet peeve that Brad has had and brought to us years ago. I'll let him tell you the story here in just a minute. It'll be a repeat story, but we got to connect with these people that they're just assuming Big Brother, which is the government, us. We're taking care of everything for them. We are, but they don't know how, or they don't know why. They just want to know they can go buy a license and go play. And a couple other things. And this is somebody else brought this up some time ago. I more than once in my office when I had customers in two different occasions I can remember real clearly because it got pretty heated. I had two lawyers two different times in my office with a sport fishing pamphlet that had just come out in late April, about ready to go to blows over what it said because they couldn't agree what the verbiage in there told them they could or couldn't do on a particular area or time and place to fish. So why don't you share what you learned about the Seattle Boat Show just recently. Very, very important.
Yeah, part of that just goes, as you know, Nate, I've been on my soapbox about getting more youth involved for a long time, and which I think is the biggest threat we face in terms of the traditional model and how the non-consumptive and whatever we call that getting involved. But I'm giving a talk next week up in BC, and the theme is part of what I'm talking about is getting, how do you get youth more engaged, the next generation in the out of doors period. So I sent George Harris an email the other day because he always says, you know, the average, we talk about that, the average age. Well, I got a response back. In the average age of attendees at the Seattle Boat Show, in the year 2000, it was 40. That was the average age. Last year, it was 55. Now, that coupled with briefings that I've seen at WAFWA, which, again, we've talked about, where the hunting age peaks at 70, then falls off a cliff, is coming. Mm-hmm. And so the demographics, and that transcends, I have friends in the golfing industry, the number of people that are playing golf is falling off that cliff, too. So maybe there's a common thread throughout all of this, and this is coupled by the fact that, you know, our youth in high school, average age, 10 hours a day, wired. Yeah. You know, so there are correlations there, and I'm concerned about that. If I owned golf courses, if I owned Cabela's, if I was a Fish and Wildlife Agency, if I was a boat dealer, I'd be concerned about the future.
I just want to follow up. I want to make sure that you and others, Nate, I'm not being critical.
No.
I'm just deeply concerned about it because, you know, I sold out back in the end of March 2017. I thought my timing was quite good. But I'm really concerned because I'm, you know, now that I have more time to interact with my past customers and friends and colleagues, we're not trending the right way. Now, I don't know how to get that number or that percentage of caring citizens above a threshold that can help get you and us where we want to be. But boy, I'd sure like to discuss that or find some type of direction to. We need more love out there from the public, and we want to give them some back. But we need more ammunition, more help on the Hill legislatively. Sometimes, anyway, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I just wanted to bring that forward.
And this couples in, then I'll get to you, Kim. But I think we need to have a very good discussion on external public relations within the agency, and how we are marketing this message and how we need to market that message.
So I really think the love is out there. It's just how we engage it. Dennis Da Silva sitting there doesn't mind, I'm going to tell a little anecdote that I told at lunch to some of you. And Dennis is a member of our diversity advisory group and has engaged with the department in that way quite intensively. We see him regularly at our meetings now, giving testimony. And he's also an avid birder, and we birders talk to each other. We have all sorts of listservs. We've got eBird, and so Dennis presented really excellent testimony, really thoughtful testimony about the Sharptail periodic status report and the recommendation by staff, and actually was influential in having the commission decide to actually move in a little bit different direction. Following that, Dennis put out a couple of messages over one of the listservs that goes through the state, kind of saying, okay, birders, where were you? And especially from the east side where the Sharptails are. One of the things we talk about on these bird websites is what we found, you know, interesting finds, so we can all run out and chase them. And I have to tell you, every time a birder sees a sharp tail in this state, it gets reported. It is a very big deal to see a sharp tail grouse. So why was not every birder in Washington talking about this status report and out advocating? They should have been. They care. But they don't understand. You know, we just need to get it out there. Thank you, Dennis, for helping out.
I was going to hold my fire until I heard you say that the advisory group is going to probably go longer. I think that the advisory group and staff are doing really high quality work, and I've come to both meetings now, certainly not for long enough, but I also agree that the engagement has been incredible. But there's a however, and I'd like to point out that I completely agree with Kim. What I see us doing here is setting a baseline and setting our status quo and doing our budget and zero-based and all of that, and we need to do that. But when it comes to being visionary or opportunity for increased funding, aside from a bunch of well-worn ideas like increasing fees and getting more general fund, I'm not sure that's the group to do it. I'm reminded of I just read a book called Thank You for Being Late by Thomas Friedman. This is relevant in an odd way. But the point of the book is that technology is increasing so fast that there's nobody in the world that has any idea what's really going on right now, and that's not going to change. As part of that, they talk a lot about Google. Google has a very well-regarded subset of itself, which is a committee that meets, I don't know how often, it's actually a whole office. And what they do is they throw out the most ridiculous ideas you can come up with to advance. And nobody is chastised for it. Nobody said, oh, well, you know, that's not a hunter or a fisher, so we, by God, can't think about it. They consider every single idea that the smartest people in their agency can come up with, and then they call them out, and once in a while they come up with one. One was self-driving cars many years ago. So I'd like to see us do some visionary work in terms of our external relations, and we've talked about this so many times. And I'd also like us to be very aware, and I think we have to say this every time, that we know what our mandate is to conserve and protect. We also know that our hunters and fishers conserve and protect. They're a major part of this agency, and we're spending pretty much every bit of money we have conserving and protecting with a small group. So opportunity is outside of that. So is funding is outside of that. We aren't going to get there until we start really seriously thinking about that. And there's a bunch of money out there. I agree with Kim. There's a bunch of money out there if we can think about how to get it. The one other, just to take one tiny digression, one more paragraph. At the meeting yesterday, it was pretty interesting because I don't know if it was just my timing or if they sit around and talk about the commission all the time. But for the time I was there, there was a very spirited discussion about us. I think it was sparked by, it came up several times, but the question was whether they should allow the commission to do fee setting or not. And oh my gosh, there was some very strong opinions about that, mostly negative. No way. They're a bunch of politicals. Don't get them involved in fee setting. It was real good for me to sit there and hear all that, and I don't know if those meetings are recorded or if you could synopsize that, but they also went through all the agencies in the state, including parks and a whole bunch of others. Most agencies do their own fee setting. So I think that's just something we should remember. Again, and the joke yesterday, everybody was picking on Nate yesterday, too. And the joke was he wasn't wearing a tie, even though I don't think anybody else was wearing a tie. But please just, I think that this commission, just from what I'm hearing and seeing, I think we're going to be saying something like this pretty much every time budget comes up. So it's not reflective on your work, because your work is great.
Yeah, and just to add to one of those thoughts, and I concur, Nate, I like the tie. It's nice.
Okay.
Bill needed somebody to, you know, compliment him today. I would like to see, I mean, we have 49 other states out there that are doing something along this line. Best practices, what states are engaging in the most out-of-the-box way? I mean, we should be able to dedicate a little bit of time of some in external affairs to do a search of that, you know, just to start looking at what are some of the things that we could adopt without, you know, painstakingly long debate that other states say, hey, we've done this and it works. Because they're all facing the same thing. So, yeah.
And right along with that, Brad, I agree. What agencies or what states are successfully marketing their programs?
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. Exactly. I mean, you know, if we're going to get ahead of this, we need to find ways to engage our public to care. Yeah. When you mention eBird as a great platform for a user group, you know, and there are others that exist for other user groups that we need to get engaged with. We only recently launched a Facebook page since I was here. It's been a short time. And, you know, the advisory groups, I do not want to discount them at all. We get very important feedback and important direction from those groups. But if we're going to engage youth, the way people participate is completely changed. Look at any organization, a Kiwanis club, the local Pogie club, the on, they're the old white guys, okay? And youth do not participate. They do not join. There continue to be active, but they do it in different ways, and we need to discover those ways and take advantage of them. We're never going to get ahead of this curve. All of the examples of funding methods that were explored, that list I've seen many times. There's nothing new there. What needs to be new is how we get to the public so they better understand our role in their lives and what they like to do and how they can influence that. So I just agree with the level of concern there is with the changing demographic and the lack of ability for this agency to move in the direction to lead that. We will always have budget problems, and we'll never improve that circumstance until we have more believers that we're doing the right job to their benefit. And we get back to marketing again. We just have failed. We have a terrible reputation for communication. That's been recently revitalized. I've been told time and time again, why don't people come to the public meetings? Because the pattern in the past was they came to a meeting and were told what was going to happen. They didn't care how they felt about it. That's changing, but we need to move in that direction and do a better job of communication and marketing to our public.
Nate, you remember when a few years ago we started the Youth Advisory Board or group? Mm-hmm. That's when we started to ask them, how should we engage you? You know, how should we engage your generation into the future? And we just started to get, I mean, really dynamic young people, as you remember, and then it dissipated. But as Commissioner Grable said, if we don't ask that next generation these questions, we're not going to go into a future that's very bright for them. I mean, it doesn't make sense. I'm one of those people that, like Freeman says, so much technology, I don't know how it's going on. But, you know, and again, we're backing you on all this. You know, we're there. You're seeing frustration that is a lot of times during regular meetings we can't vent because we have to stick to the schedule of other frustrations.
I'm glad the workshop provides the venting forum for you. So, but I do not take any of this as criticism of me. I think it's a very constructive dialogue for you. This is your workshop, and this is where you all need to determine the path forward of the concerns and crises that you're bringing up. We're here as staff to support you in setting that policy direction.
You know, just, I think the interrupt, but this golf thing. I was talking to these golf people about, which I don't play golf, about how they're engaging more people. They're trying to speed it up because not everybody can afford to, whatever, 5 hours to play 18 holes or whatever. I know some of you might have heard this.
You were bad at golf. You took you that.
I don't know. I've never done it. Like Granny Clampett says, she went out to shoot golf and didn't find any golf, but she didn't shoot any golf, but she found their eggs. Boiled them, and they still didn't taste any good. But what they're doing, they're enlarging the holes to speed up putting. So they're making, they're making like
I might take them golf
yard wide. I mean, I don't know if that helps more people get involved or just this one of those wow, that's stupid ideas. But sorry.
Well, a number of comments about marketing and external communications. That's something that certainly I've heard the commission speak to at your October meeting when the agency brought forward a marketing plan. There's been a couple big tent committee meetings where that's come up, as well as there's two or three pretty significant findings in the matrix report that talks about the department coming up with a better public engagement plan and even utilizing everything from new technology to have our commission meetings broadcast across the state, different ways for advisory groups to participate through different technological solutions. I've asked Bruce Botka and Rob Geddes in the director's office to help us work on this communication strategy that you all have mentioned. And so that's something that I can see us bringing forward to you probably in the June timeframe.
Larry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to bring up one public relations tool that I don't know how long ago it was out and about, but it went away for whatever reason, maybe budgetary. It used to be a 30-minute film, Wild About Washington, mm-hmm. and it was before I was on the commission, and I thought it was so unique. Great storytelling. They'd be over in Ephrata or Walla Walla, and next thing they'd be in Friday Harbor. I thought it was really special. And I don't know, I can't think of a better way, frankly, that now with all the YouTubes and all that stuff that we shouldn't re-engage that. But that's a comment. My question of you, Nate, you made some great comments, your colleague up there. What can we do to help you? What can we do to help you? And I mean, be candid.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair Carpenter, just real briefly, you know, on our different budget lists and the executive management team, over the past couple of years, we've identified a need for a videographer. That was that person that we had in the past that would do that production and filming of those Wild About Washington series. But I think, you know, looking at today's internet and social marketing approaches, it's now that 2-minute clips. It's the live Facebook feed. And we actually had an event here a little while ago where we partnered, I believe, with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a waterfowl specialist, and we're down at a duck blind and just talked about the different waterfowl that are available and moving through the area. And it was really popular, a lot of really good feedback. And it's just a 2-minute clip. And so, you know, we do really cool work in this department, and so part of this is also arming our staff with the GoPro and turn on your smartphone and show what that deer capture looks like, or what it looks like when we're releasing trout in a hatchery, or surveying reds in a stream. So, anyways, and that's is a really convenient way. It's easy. We don't necessarily need to have the production quality there because folks are used to the granularity and a little bit of the choppiness of YouTube nowadays, and that's an accepted way to communicate.
There's just an unending amount of destinations in this state where people don't go to. Yeah. People from the west side don't go to the east side. People from the east side don't come here. Yeah. But there's so many destinations and opportunities. I mean, razor clams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I would put it up for consideration.
And I think you've seen some of our work with the how-to fish videos that we have, and those have been very, really popular and useful. Just a.
I just wanted to also, I've brought this up for the past couple of years in Region 1. Steve, the regional director, got a couple GoPro cameras, and they're running a contest, and they have some absolutely spectacular. They have to be 2 minutes long, you know, and it's been exactly the things you're talking about, how to get eggs from fish. And last year the winning video was cleaning a bathroom or cleaning a toilet at the access site.
Right.
It was fabulous. You know, just all of these things that go to making your experience a good one.
Yeah.
So it's there, and I don't know that we need a videographer like you're saying anymore. We need GoPro cameras.
Yeah. But having that ability for the staff person to help with the social media postings and things like that.
Exactly.
Hey, just speaking to this again, I've done... Through my website, you can access almost 200 videos on everything from even cooking to, you know, how to rig a bobber and jig. The most popular one I've ever done was the first one. It was 2 minutes, the easiest way to clean a trout. And if you Google...
Give it to somebody else to do.
Yeah, and I just shot that.
Yeah, give it to your wife.
And this was done with a little tiny... generations old camera, and there's been over 150,000 views. I mean, if you Google the easiest way to clean a trout, that's what comes up. That's just a demonstration of how easy it is to access those things.
Well, Mr. Chair, I will try to circle us back a little bit here.
Yeah.
Well, real quick before you end, I'd like to get some feedback on this in 30 soon.
Okay.
Talk to Joe over there. Joe, are you over there?
All right.
The survey that you mentioned about what are those kind of best practices and things, Ross Strategic has pulled together some of that work this past spring. And so that's something I think we'll try to get in front of our advisory group.
Was that
as
best
far
practices
as other,
or what?
Other states' conservation funding.
Not marketing.
Yep. Not marketing would be one component, but just what were the different funding mechanisms that were out there for diversity funding? You know, the sales tax idea. Missouri is kind of the gold standard, I think, in terms of having a dedicated slice of sales tax devoted to fish and wildlife conservation. I believe there's another Midwestern state that during the recession got legislation passed that when their state's economy recovers and it's at a certain level, then the sales tax provision kicks in. And so they were able to pass a conservation tax during an area that did not affect people's wallets, and it would only trigger when the economy rebounded. So just thinking about some of those pretty savvy strategies as far as when to timing and when legislation goes into effect. And then a game changer that I think could be just pretty incredible will be the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. And so Megan will brief you on that here in just another 15 minutes or so. Did want to share, so we have this review of our zero-based budget, the entire operating and capital budget of the agency. Did want to share with you this diagram that Ross Strategic put together, and I want to turn it over to Elizabeth for navigating this.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Commissioners, this is just another, this is just another way to display the budget information that you have, and after the recent the conversation you just had about engaging and YouTube and Commissioner Grayville, I've seen your easiest to clean the trout video because my son recently became a trout fisherman and I had no idea.
That's wonderful.
But so I hesitate because I don't know that this quite captures the spirit of that discussion, but it is another way that's not boxes and bar charts to show budget data. So these circles are, these larger circles here are the outcomes, the boxes on the table that Nate's been showing you. These smaller circles here are the little nested strategies that are under each of the boxes. Their size to reflect the relative amount of money going to each one. And then you can tag and filter these is really any way you want to. And we've just put in a few examples so you can see. So you can hover over this and say, what's the work that looks at protecting ecosystems? Or what's the fishing work? Or what's the hunting work? Or the work that's so far tagged as for recreation, right? You could also click on any one of these. I'm going to click on this one. And you can embed information there. So you can embed words. That's a lot of words. But you can also embed tables. So this table shows the different funding sources that go into that work, which I think is monitoring and managing fish populations, and where they come from. So we're this is all, the back end of this is Excel, same as the back end of the spreadsheet that and the box diagram that Nate's been showing you. So it doesn't represent really any additional work to sort of play with mapping and tagging it in this way. And certainly we're happy to share the link, and if any of you have tags or suggestions that you think people would like a line of sight into the work and the budget information through, we can add those. Is that anything else you want me to cover? Okay.
So in March, I'm hoping that you'll have us back for another workshop. And at that time slot, what we'd like to bring you is just an update on the department's plan to implement the matrix report. We gave you a preview of some plans at your Ridgefield meeting. I'd like to come back to you and make sure that that's front and center, as well as I hope to be in a spot where we're offering some funding targets for the 2019-21 budget, and we'll need your guidance on if those targets are correct, and then if so, what are some of the revenue solutions that we should start exploring and start applying the principles to the targets and ultimately those solutions. And then lastly, we'll have an update on the long-term funding plan. Again, that's going to be pitched to you in April for adoption so that we can turn it into the legislature on May 1st. So a couple big meetings coming up, and just wanted to make sure you were aware of what was on the horizon. So with that, we'll step away, and I'd ask Melinda Posner to come up, and she will answer one of your questions that you had at Ridgefield about the Ruckels House process.
Question for you. So in March,
in terms of pursuing new revenue proposals, are you planning on then bringing a suite of alternatives with a guess at how much each one of them might generate?
I think what, Mr. Chair, Commissioner McIsaac, I think we'll be in a spot to bring forward what are the funding targets, and if those are levels that you're comfortable with us proceeding with, and if so, then we'll start exploring what are those different revenue solutions. So it's a little bit of a kind of a staged process here, but we can have a sense of, for instance, right now it looks like my best guess is that we're looking at a $26 million shortfall. How much of that shortfall would you like us to live within our means next biennium? Which areas would you like to see reductions? Which areas would you like us to try to go submit a request for general fund? Or is there an opportunity, for instance, for some sort of across the board fee increase? Or is it a specific fee increase for certain licenses? That'll be the type of direction that we'll be seeking in March.
What about other alternatives? Like, you're going to speak in a moment to this Discovery Pass business, I guess. But, I mean, would this be the time where the commission will be asked to make a policy decision on these are the revenue-increasing alternatives we would like to move forward, and here's the ones we want to just drop right now?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be good to understand those targets, and if we can get to the different revenue solutions, that would be great. But I anticipate, we might have within our long-term funding plan, here's the budget need, here's some budget principles, and that's maybe as far as we can get by May 1st, knowing that you have until August to submit your August and September to submit our agency request legislation. So it gives us a couple, 3 months to further shape and mold the different funding solutions that you're discussing. Is that helpful?
Well, I guess what I'm hearing on that last part is not to expect a suite of alternatives in March with, if we did this, the potential would be this number. I mean, one alternative would be ask for all of it for a new general fund. The chances of that happening are, you know, you might speculate on that. That'd be one alternative. Another one might be this Discovery Pass thing. Another one might be add more advertising on the website or who knows what. But I guess what I'm hearing you now say is, no, don't expect that in March.
Because some of those revenue ideas we'll need to research as far as whether or not we even have the authority to pursue. And so part of this might be that, you know, we have a few more months to do some homework, for instance, on advertising on the department's site, for instance. Is that something that the commission wants us to explore? We'd want to make sure that we have the statutory authority to do that. That might be a bill that we bring before you that we'd recommend to the governor's office in September.
I forgot the container tax one.
Okay, well, I'll turn it over to Melinda.
Are you getting this service?
My email's not coming in.
What's that?
My email's not coming in here.
What's that?
Are you getting service?
A few, yeah.
Straightforward. That's pretty straightforward. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. I'm Melinda Posner. I work in the Lands Division of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I head a section called Wildlife Area Planning, Recreation, and Outreach. So appreciate all your comments that you shared just now in that discussion. So thank you for the opportunity to share a little bit about the Recreation Access Proviso process. I'm happy to have an informal discussion. I think we have a little shorter time, so I have an overview, but I'd also like to encourage your questions and comments. So you're probably familiar with the Discover Pass, and you probably know that we manage and administer that with the state parks and Department of Natural Resources. And fiscal year 2018, the program generated $23 million, and our percent of that is 8%. And so that does fund operation and maintenance activities that support recreation. So what I'm going to do is just give you a little background on the process. The Discover Pass has been in existence since 2011. It has been a pretty successful program, but there are some complexities in terms of merging three agencies' lands and integrating exemptions that exist from one agency and not necessarily on another. So the budget proviso in 2016 said, look at improving consistency, simplicity, equity, and also maintaining the fiscal health of the agencies. And the budget proviso from the legislature also directed a neutral third party to lead a collaborative process to look into those issues associated with the recreation access fee system. So that process started with a contract with the Ruckelhaus Center. The three agencies were represented as the core team, and we met regularly with the Ruckelhaus Center to scope the project, review products, and provide input and direction and information about our respective agencies. The first product was a situation assessment, which was interviewing 48 interviews with 63 individuals to understand the issues and concerns, perceptions around the recreation access fee system, and also to gauge the climate for a collaborative process to address some of the complexities and improve the program and ultimately increase revenue potentially. This is a list of the different teams that were created. A leadership team was a group that would make recommendations and review the work of the other committees. The agencies were represented as ex officio members and attended all the leadership team meetings. But a wide range of user groups were in the leadership team, as well as the coordination work group and exemption work group, including representatives from the Hunter Heritage Council, WWRC, Coastal Conservation, and WTA, Backcountry Horsemen, Cowlitz Tribe, as well as a number of agencies such as the Veterans Administration and DSHS, who were working with us on the exemption topics. Okay, so this is just a schematic showing that process over the 6 to 9 months and leadership team meetings, work group meetings. Again, one group was focused on the exemption piece, trying to look at equity among users and equity among exemptions. And the past coordination group was really focused on how do we improve the system overall? What kind of a tag works the best? Do we assess folks who walk as well as drive into recreation areas, as well as where else can we sell and where else can we provide information that's common across all agencies, including not just state agencies, but federal agencies who have recreation lands. Another group that came together was the survey work group, who provided a lot of input about how a survey should be structured. So a public opinion survey was done, which included a random sample of residents, as well as what they termed a convenience survey. And this was sent out to all kinds of organizations. Each agency tapped their own databases, used our own methods for reaching out to our users, and that generated a lot of additional input. The data was collected so that it could be looked at both from the statewide sample that was representative and the total of all folks who were responding. So some of the key findings, there's quite a long report on the website, Ruckle House website, if you want to look into the detail. But these are some of the key findings. The majority of pass purchasers indicate that they purchase a Discover Pass. And I think that was asked, you know, within the last 12 months. And the second most purchased pass was the annual Northwest Forest Pass. Nearly half of all pass purchasers said that the existing system is confusing, hard to navigate. And another comment at the very bottom, or another key finding, was reducing the number of passes and permits required was a very important consideration of 63%. Another key point is that over half of pass purchasers in all surveys feel adequately funding public lands is very important. So the groups developed a set of options and recommendations. They looked at three key systems, and then a decision tool to consider when looking at future and existing exemptions. So I was just going to quickly review these options. The pass-free option is a state, maybe if you imagine, before the Discover Pass existed, where there was no pass or permit required to access state lands. So it would eliminate the state passes required for vehicular access, which would do a lot towards reducing simplicity and eliminating some of the confusion with different agency reg restrictions and exemptions. Does require identifying a sustainable funding source, and one of those options for that was considered a license tab. But the group also thought it could be generated in other ways, similar to the conclusions that the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Sustainable Recreation came up with. Folks did talk about increased taxes and those sorts of things to fund the pass-free option. The two-vehicle option is about really maximizing on the existing program, making improvements that make it easier for folks, reducing passes, expanding exemptions across state agencies, extending the 12 free days at state parks to be both at DNR and DFW lands. Again, so a lot of similarities between the two-vehicle and one-vehicle that get at pretty somewhat simple steps to make the program more consistent and easier for people to navigate. But the one-vehicle idea is that potentially folks could buy a pass for less than the current annual pass, which is $30, and that might also generate new batch of folks who want to purchase the pass more regularly. Those were the three options. I mentioned some of these common elements, the consistent free days, general funding in the case of the second two, general fund to manage the public resources, reimbursement to the agencies for exemptions, and using the evaluation criteria to consider exemptions. The leadership team came to consensus that the preferred recommendation to meet all the objectives of the proviso was the pass-free option. It would do the most for reducing the complexity and the confusion. But they also added that the two vehicle and the other options that they had come up with also they would like to be considered and were recommended as well. So those options and recommendations were packaged into a final report that was submitted to the legislature in early December. And since that time, there have been a couple of bills that address some of the issues around the proviso recommendations. And currently, I think it's 2SHB 2652, has passed through appropriations and is in rules currently. And it is a bill that combines a lot of the common elements that are the relatively easy things to institute pretty quickly. 12 free days, expanding across the three agencies, extending the disabled veterans exemption that's currently at state parks to be across all three agencies, eliminating the confusion with the snow park pass, as well as some confusion and what was perceived and could be true, ORV users having to pay for both the car they drive in on and the towed vehicles they have with them. There's also a budget provided. Yes.
So the preferred pass-free option, I don't believe that's in the bill, is it?
No.
And that sounds to me an awful lot like going back to where we were prior to the Discover Pass, which, given that we only get 8% of the current amount, may or may not be a good thing. I think it's very, very risky, though. So I are you going to catch us up on where we are now?
Where we are now is that SB, SHB 2652 includes a suite of common elements that are really mostly reflected in the two-vehicle, kind of continuing what we have now as a two-vehicle recreation access pass system. And the budget proviso that's in the governor's budget would provide monies to analyze the fiscal impacts and potential implementation costs of the other options.
I'm not sure if what our role is in this, but speaking for myself, if we are able to go beyond current funding in any way, I would like to see us argue for a larger share.
Yeah.
Especially since we don't have fee setting authority as State Parks does. I don't want my comments misrepresented. I'm a huge proponent of State Parks. The way that this has progressed, the Discover Pass has basically saved them, and they are much on much more stable funding than they used to be. Now we need to look for our own funding, and if we get into looking at, car tabs, everybody knows we have our own problems with those. But if we get into some sort of thing and we need some direction from this group as to what we should be striving for, I'd like to have another briefing just on that, if that could be okay.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the commission, yes.
This is a question for Joe or you all. Following up on that, is the current bill that is alive, does it have a different sharing situation? And has the department's position been to anything like that, advocating for something a little bit different?
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
Commissioner McIsaac, maybe just a little history. This is history according to STORE, so it, you know, it has my biases in it, but you know, we were pretty involved, of course, from the very beginning. In fact, this started off, if some of you knew Dave Brittell, and Dave was our wildlife and later our lands policy assistant. But Dave and others had been pursuing ways to get a new audience involved and collect revenues off of people that, use our lands. And had an idea around a Discover Pass, something like a Discover Pass that would pay and allow for parking on state lands. And we went to the Department of Natural Resources, and they were very interested in working with us. This is back in about 2009, 2010. And so when we sat down together as two agencies and said, what is it that you need? You know, we want to focus on O&M, both agencies, operations and maintenance of lands. And we each came up with numbers that totaled about $11 million. And again, I'm pulling this off of memory, but I think it illustrates why we're where we're at. So we started to talk to other agencies. We talked to Parks. At the time, Parks wasn't really interested in being part of a triad there. And so we started to explore with legislators the possibility of moving a two-agency bill forward for lands O&M. And the recession hit. And so this would have been the planning for 09-11 biennium. And in Governor Gregoire's budget, I believe it was $65 million of general fund. All of Parks' general fund was removed. And so then the dynamic of this proposal changed. And frankly, my reading of the tea leaves is the DNR and Fish and Wildlife probably wouldn't have been able by ourselves to pull off this bill because there were such larger issues. But when Parks, all of Parks' general funding was eliminated, again, around $65, $66 million, they started warming up to this idea of a Discover Pass. and the political support was so much more strengthened by having the risk of the loss of Parks involved. And it wasn't just about this, you know, operations and maintenance of these other lands, but it was actual Parks in everybody's backyard and across the whole state. And when you combine the $65 million with the $5.5 million that each of the DNR and Fish and Wildlife had, I don't know if those numbers work out, but it was something like that. That's how we ended up with 8%. It wasn't a choice ahead of time. You get 8%. It's how much did you need? Okay, we need 4.5, 66, 65. And so those numbers have you know, the pass was created. We went through some growing pains. I think the first two or three years, Melinda and others in the agency spent lots of hours evaluating ways to improve the pass, ways to sell more. There was a lot of resistance. We had done some surveys via WSU on how many state households might purchase this pass. The surveys were very optimistic. And so we started off at making about 50% of what the survey said we were going to make, but it's been growing every year. There have been improvements made every year. So we haven't a long-winded way of telling you where the 8% came from, but because we continue to see growth in the sales of these passes and more acceptance, and some minor improvements haven't gone back and addressed the 8%. We've talked about it a lot. I think you need to be careful because this wasn't about providing O&M to Fish and Wildlife. This was about keeping parks open. And so to open up that debate again, you know, it's hard to tell where it might go once it's opened up.
So
Simone, if you have anything to do with changing from that fadeable, awful paper to the current past, thank you.
Okay. Yes, that was something that we worked on for quite a while as a three-agency team, and I would say we do have a pretty good group working together now. Just might add that we met today, our coordination team, and talked about the implementation of 2652 and or other changes. And there are a couple of other things that we have talked about, including looking at a consistent price point and what additional revenue that would generate. The state and federal combination pass, again, that survey mentioned, the Discover Pass and Northwest Forest Pass are ones that often people want both. And if we could find a convenient way to either be able to sell them at the same place, you know, develop a combo pass at the same price, potentially, that's something that we think we might be able to move forward that we didn't get a lot of traction on in this process because there were so many issues. So it still is something important that potentially would be a revenue increase as well. We do have some costs that we're going to absorb in implementation with this in terms of having a new pass for disabled veterans and some of those pieces. So we're going to continue to look at reducing the number of passes and simplifying that way. But no other specific plans about increasing our allocation or changing the cost of the pass currently. So open for any other questions or comments.
Something I hear about in my region is a confusion about where the pass is required. If we are in DNR land, do I need it or don't I? Still remains a lot of confusion on that. And
there it is.
You can speak to how you're going to clarify that.
Yes, one of the ideas in all of the options was to have a common information portal, have all the state agency information in one place, be able to make it searchable as you can for at WTA and many of the other types of interactive maps if you want to recreate. And so that's one way of having common information that is accurate. Also, by eliminating the exemption, or its exclusion, I would say, I'll say it the other way, by expanding it to our lands and DFW DNR lands, there'll be less things that stand out as this is only for fish and wildlife or only for state parks. But there are a lot of cases, a lot of folks express that, not being able to know and not really caring either. You know, just tell me what pass I need and I'll get it so I can go where I want to go.
That's a great idea. We've talked a lot about our own website, and we are in the process of redoing it. And one of our things is, how do we let people know where our lands are? Yeah. I had never thought about a Discover Pass website, but if we do that, and we can also use that as basically advertising for our public lands, we are that's a great idea. Yeah.
So we do have a Discover Pass website and the common information portal conversation we continued today. And our in our agency currently, the Lands Showcase initiative is about marketing our lands. And it includes a couple of key subtasks like getting our recreation facilities geospatially represented in our database so that you could search them on a map, and actually creating an interactive visitor map and updated recreation and conservation messages to go live on the new website. So those are things that we're working towards, and if in fact we work towards a common portal, we would expect that those layers of data would be available for wherever this could sit, whether that's RCO or the tourism board. Those have been some of the ideas that have come up. Or all of the above, yes.
Citations issued for non-compliance?
Yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that is something that originally the citation fees were not coming to the agencies, and that was changed a year or two into it. And then 2 years ago, through the legislative session, we worked closely with of the counties and the court systems to have reimbursement to the counties, and I guess that just hasn't got traction. But that was, again, to help really have that compliance rate go up, and folks not expect to have their violation thrown out when they got to court. So I can't tell you right now. I can get back to you, though, on how it's changed.
I'm just curious whether there's a whole lot of them or just some, or, you know, because
whenever
I've gone in, and I've forgotten mine on a few times, you know, it's been in the other car sort of thing, so I'm looking over my shoulder.
I would say overall, it's gone down as the program has been more accepted, but actual numbers, I'd have to get back to you.
Okay.
Another quick comment. You know, you're able to buy it's called a static tag for your vehicle to launch at state parks. That's something I know several of my friends do, and they just simply stick it in their windshield. And it doesn't fade, it doesn't go anywhere, and it's always there.
Yeah.
My Discover Pass always falls apart trying to jam it onto my rearview mirror. The dealer always very helpfully staples it to that. They're cumbersome. It just seems to me, and I've asked about this before, why don't we just get a static tag? Then you put it on once, and it's there.
Yep. That has been recommended by various times through the process, and it was talked about through the proviso. I think it's something still to be looked at in terms of implementation. Since it is a two-car system, it's more difficult to reproduce a pass that maybe was going to be affordable for the program to be transferable between two cars, or to have one that, or actually to provide two to the customer.
Yeah, provide two.
And it was something tested in the survey. It was interesting because I think the expectation was that was going to be really high, that the clean kind of a thing would be high, and most folks, the percentage was, well, the hang tag is working pretty well from a good percentage, but again, that may be from kind of accepting the program over time, because that was a real complaint early on, too. Thank you.
Thank you. That was.
Thanks, Melinda. And so now we'll have Megan West do an overview of the Recovering America's Wildlife Act.
Is there hope, Megan?
I hope so. I'm optimistic.
That's good.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Smith, Commissioners, Director Storr. My name is Megan West, and I am the federal coordinator within the Director's Office. So I'm here today to talk about Recovering America's Wildlife Act, or in short, RAWA, because it's pretty much a mouthful to say every time you want to indicate what it is. So to start this off, and before I really dive into the act, I would like to set the stage as to why this legislation is so significant by briefly talking about the current primary federal funding mechanisms that we rely on. So we have the Pittman-Robertson Act, PR, Dingell-Johnson Act, DJ, and then the State and Tribal Wildlife Grants, or SWIG. And so from the slide, you can see that combined PR and DJ contribute about $1 billion annually, primarily for game wildlife and sport fisheries. And then since 2001, the state and tribal wildlife grants provide about $60 million annually nationwide. Of the PR and DJ dollars, we receive about $15 million in PR, and then $7 million in DJ, and then that's specifically dedicated to game species, and then the $1.2 million that we receive from SWIG is for our non-game species and their habitats. So just looking at those funding levels, you can see that there's quite a disparity for game and non-game species. And so for the purposes of this presentation, I'm going to be focusing on funding relative to priority species and their habitats. So to start this off, about SWIG. In order to receive SWIG funding, Congress requires each state and U.S. territory to develop a state wildlife action plan, which is a proactive, comprehensive conservation strategy that identifies species of greatest conservation need and prioritizes actions to safeguard those species and their habitats before they become more rare and costly to protect. Nationwide, there's been an identification of 12,000 species of greatest conservation need, and as of 2015 in Washington, we've identified 268. So overall, the statistics are pretty telling of the state of our fish and wildlife, both nationwide and in Washington. While SWIG as a funding source has been critical to some conservation successes, there's an increasing recognition nationwide that there needs to be a greater investment in our conservation of priority species and their habitats. So this leads me to the panel that was convened in 2014, responding to the growing concern over the lack of funding. The Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, or AFWA, convened the Blue Ribbon Panel on Sustaining America's Diverse Fish and Wildlife Resources, which was comprised of business and conservation leaders, to evaluate and recommend a more sustainable and proactive funding approach to avert a fish and wildlife conservation crisis. So what did the Blue Ribbon Panel look for? It looked for funding mechanisms that support conservation of at-risk species and habitats as prioritized in state and wildlife action plans, a dedicated source of funding, a sustainable and not reliant on annual appropriations, and a new or supplemental source of funding that completes the wildlife conservation model. So what they ended up landing on was a $1.3 billion redirection of resources from energy and mineral development on public lands. This funds critical conservation without requiring Congress to levy a new tax and ensures that some of the proceeds from energy and mineral extraction on public lands are invested in conservation. Currently, the majority of these funds are just directed to general government services. And so getting into the act itself, so Recovering America's Wildlife Act, to reflect the representation and recommendation of the Blue Ribbon Panel, AFWA spearheaded a grassroots approach to garnering support for bipartisan legislation through the Alliance for America's Fish and Wildlife. So in 2016, the first piece of legislation was introduced. That was H.R. 5650. It was introduced by Congressman Young and Congresswoman Dingell. It was referred to the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Lands, but it did not move out. So they kind of regrouped. There were some changes that needed to be made to the original legislation. They also needed to identify a new sponsor. So in December of 2017, Congressman Fortenberry and Congresswoman Dingell introduced H.R. 4647. That was referred to the House Natural Resources Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Oceans. It is currently awaiting a hearing. I just learned the other day that Congresswoman Del Bene will be signing on as a co-sponsor. Currently, we're in conversations with Congressman Reichert's office. The staffers are going to be briefing him next week to see if there's a way in which we can garner his support as well.
Are there Washington members on that subcommittee?
There's not. Unfortunately, we don't have any of our congressional delegation either on the Natural Resources Committees or the Ags. Or Ag Committee in the House. On the Senate side, it's different.
Yeah.
But we do not have a piece of legislation that has been sponsored yet. There are conversations with Senator Barrasso, but the Barrasso.
Barrasso is from where and what party?
He's a Republican, and I forgot what state he's from, but I can get that information to you.
So why is Senator Cantwell not considered, since she sits on the appropriate committee and has shown interest in these kinds of issues? Why haven't we thought about?
So there's a couple. AFWA's approach to this is to approach a chair of a committee rather than the ranking. Currently, in this administration, because the Republicans are the majority of parties in both chambers. They're approaching Republicans first to kind of get that bipartisan support. That's their goal. Senator Cantwell has been approached on this legislation, and she has indicated support should it be introduced. But there's a strategy through OFWA that, you know, they're pretty strategic about approaching certain members rather than going to the minority party.
Yeah, OFWA has a dedicated staff person just for this.
Sean Sabell.
Right. And would it be possible to get kind of updates?
Oh, yeah.
On this, you know, from OFWA? I mean, you know, that you don't have to do those.
Oh.
But Sean could, you know, whatever Sean, he must be sent us something out. And if the commission could get those. Because I don't know at what point they're going to be wanting co-sponsors,
yeah,
but a lot of us could have ideas. And I know Debbie Dingell from Michigan. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. They would definitely appreciate that support, and we'll, I can talk with Sean and see if there's a way in which he can engage commissions. I think that's a great idea.
And I think it's not just us. I think for 49 other states, it would be very beneficial. Because I heard him talk or give a briefing about this last month. And
and I would just remind the commission that we have a policy on this that talked about our engagement, so we're committed certainly to help.
Commissioner Thornburg, I think that's an excellent idea, and you know, I'm sure the other commissions around the nation would like that in as well. So
it's now 3 o'clock, we need to wrap this up. I'm sorry.
Paranoid side of me just flared up a little bit. Is there anything? I'm a 100% supporter of this, and I hope we get the money, and I hope we can find the match. Is there anything in any of these bills, since it is money that's derived from basically mining and oil drilling on public land, is there anything in their statement or otherwise that encourages expansion of those activities?
Currently, as written, it's for the existing.
It's existing, right.
Mm-hmm. Currently, as written, and are we watching that?
Mm-hmm. We are.
Yeah.
So, going next to the annual funding formula, which is really exciting for Washington, you can see that it's a 75% to 25% split between the federal and state match. From the federal side, we'd be receiving about $26.5 million annually. We'd be obligated to contribute about $8.8 million annually. It's implemented the same way that state wildlife grants are. It utilizes a swap and directs funding to priority species and habitats. Its apportionment is based on the state's land area and the state human population, and funding is administered through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service through the Wildlife Conservation and Restoration sub-account within Pittman and Robertson. That sub-account was authorized, I think, in 2001, and there is currently no funding that exists for it. And so, speaking to the benefits to Washington, currently, SWIG leverages other funding sources to survey, monitor, and research species, habitats, and systems to develop and deliver conservation actions. It also sustains healthy populations of diverse wildlife and habitats and issues permits for wildlife rehabilitation, falconry, taxidermy, and scientific collection. But with the passage of RAWA, there could be additional funding that will enhance opportunities to partner with private landowners, increase enforcement presence, assess and stabilize priority habitats and species, and increase customer service for local governments, and then promote fish and wildlife conservation education and outreach. So in closing, fish and wildlife are protected public resources held in trust for all Washingtonians. Unless we start investing in proactive conservation measures, not only is the health and sustainability of our fish and wildlife at risk, but also our quality of life, our outdoor heritage, and our economic prosperity. And so I think that RAWA serves as that opportunity to finally invest in the conservation of these species. So.
Commissioner Farber's uninvited
yet. Yeah, Nate and I were deliberating on which picture to include, and I was like, oh. Yeah. Thanks, Nate.
Yeah.
Well,
can I ask you any other
thanks,
questions? We do stand ready to help with this. This is something that
this is huge.
Yeah. Well, I think getting Sean's message out to all the states and an update, because that, you know, at some point when we pull the trigger on certain things so we can make some calls and that. Because when they go for co-signers,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Or maybe we could tie it, an unsolicited remark, to a military parade.
Thanks for the presentation. I'm just curious, you know, we all know things are not moving as quickly as we would like in Congress, particularly if there's any opposition. So I'm just kind of curious, what industries or who would be opposed to this great idea of taking money away from the oil companies and then putting into the state coffers?
You know, it's really hard, at least for me, to identify those, considering the panelists included the oil and gas industry. And so in thinking of those that would oppose that, especially that being a diversion of their income, I can't really think of anything, because the panel was so widespread in its representation that it's kind of hard. Yeah. I mean, if I can think of something,
that's good. I mean, I think, you know, given that there's consensus, you would think that something like this could move, but, you know, certainly Congress has got other maybe more pressing issues that they're dealing with. So, you know, that's always my limited experience. It's very frustrating. You know, you kind of have a great idea, you don't see any opposition, and then for whatever reason it doesn't move. So
you're saying the word government and frustration in the same sentence?
But I mean, I guess the you just keep at it. That's that's all you can do.
Yeah, so. And we're here.
Commissioner.
One last question.
Yeah, I was impressed in what I knew about the panel's work and how thoughtful they were, because I think the land and water conservation thing also comes out of this. So that was a question that was, you know, this would not replace that really important funding. I mean, they really thought through a lot of those negatives. It was quite impressive.
The panel.
Excellent panel. Yeah.
And thank you, Commissioner. And you can almost think of it as complementary. You know, LWCF is the land side of this, and this is investing in our species. So
thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner.
Look forward.